Your Honda Civic gets worse every year, but a Tesla gets better every year, right? It's like everything in the real world, physical, is depreciating, is getting worse over time. So for me, that's where this notion of software beyond the screen, software's agility, its capital intensity, its ability to improve over time is beautiful, but it's been chained to a computer. And we're seeing that change. This isn't a brand new trend. It's 5-10 years old, but you can get into your car and tap in Google Maps. Your self-driving lane keeping assist features start to feel that way. Your Aura Ring starts to feel software-like. So to me, software beyond the screen is a huge idea that is going to have many, many different incarnations.
Hey, climbers, welcome to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm your host, Jay Kapoor, general partner of VSC Ventures and co-host of Climb. Every week on this show, I speak to investors, founders, and industry experts that are building leading technologies and companies turning the tide on climate change. This week, I am so thrilled to have in our SF studio, Sunil Nagaraj, founding partner of Ubiquity Ventures. Sunil, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jay. I'm excited to be here and have a good conversation.
Me too, man. So Sunil, you back nerdy and early companies that are building in everything from robotics to AI to climate change, everything in between. You know, you've said you've chose the words nerdy and early and software beyond the screen very carefully. So let's unpack that. What makes something nerdy and early, and what is software beyond the screen?
I'm glad I get to talk about this. It's something I'm very passionate about is the way VC firms describe themselves, right? I think there's a lot of firms out there, a lot of people back ambitious founders, world-changing founders. That's kind of vague to me. And the reason I talk about nerdy and early is I think there's such specific words. So let's talk about one word to start with, nerd. For me, the idea of a nerd is not someone who wears thick glasses. It's not somebody who talks with a weird voice. A nerd is defined by two very specific things. One is a depth in a subject that surpasses the average person by like 100x. That could be that you're nerdy about chess. It could be myself, I'm nerdy about piano, I'm nerdy about sailing, I'm nerdy about astronomy. I could talk to you for hours about all the stars and galaxies if you wanted to, I'm being serious.
Yeah.
And that depth means that I lose track of time. So nerds lose track of time when they're doing that thing that they were put on earth to do. So nerd is number one, depth. And the second part of being a nerd emerges from the depth. Because you're so deep, there's this need to evangelize the subject, right? I would love to tell you more about piano and all the different bolts and nuts and screws inside. Mm-hmm. And I would love to talk to you about astronomy. So for me, those are the kinds of people that I love hanging out with. I love backing. Are nerds who are obsessed with something and want to evangelize that something. And I think it's an open question to anybody. You know, what are you nerdy about, right? You could be nerdy about Civil War trivia. You could be nerdy about football, you know, whatever it is. But I think it's just wonderful to hang out with folks who are deep in a subject. And I think Ubiquity Ventures, I try to emanate that throughout the firm. My fund one, which was raised in 2017, is a $30 million fund when I'm talking to an average person about this.
Yeah.
If I'm talking to a physics nerd, I would tell them it's exactly the speed of light in meters per second. And that's one of the cool tidbits is there's a lot of scientific numbers, but there's only one that's a fundamental concept that's an exact number, 299792458 meters per second.
Wow.
And that's a neat little tidbit hiding in Ubiquity. And there's a lot of stuff like that. So that's nerdy. You know, we've been doing this venture thing for a little while. Early means a lot of things. Pre-seed means a lot of things. Seed means a lot of things. I think of early as like it's not working yet. You know, you just got off the ground. It's hard to use pre-seed, seed, series A these days. So actually, when I talk to folks, I say, I back teams of 1 to 3 people, usually 6 months old, 12 months old. A third of the time, it's day of incorporation. And I find that I have to use these words because the other words have gotten so muddled. So
you're 100% right. We kind of do the same thing with us where we say post-product to pre-product market fit.
I saw that, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's the sweet spot for me where it's like, you call it pre-seed, call it seed. If you've got a product, okay, now I know, you know, again, what we can do on our end to help evangelize it and help spread it. Because seed means, you know, $2 million round to $8 million round and everything in between.
All over the, I used to get annoyed about that, but now I just stopped using those words, you know, whenever I can, just talking about very early stage companies, just getting off the ground, making things work. I wrote a post about the two types of investors.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, a good question for you here. If I told you about a new company.
Yeah.
What would be the first question you would ask? What comes to mind immediately?
What problem are they solving?
Perfect.
And
okay.
For whom?
So that's a version of the first type of investor.
Yeah.
What do they do?
Yeah.
Now, in my mind, I can't imagine another question, right? Mm-hmm. I had to sort of poke around for this. About half the VCs I know ask a totally different question. They don't say, what do they do? they say, how are they doing? And this just splits, it bifurcates the whole industry to product and metrics investors, right? And clearly, I can't hide my lack of interest in metrics-based investing, like Series B. I think whether you decide if a company's worth 150 pre or 170 pre, not an interesting exercise.
Yeah.
Is this technology going to take off? Is it going to work? Is this team going to bring it to market? Very interesting exercise, which I think is sort of where you play as well.
Yeah, no, 100%. And the software beyond the screen thing was so interesting to me because initially when I saw that, I was like, oh, is he doing IoT? And it seems like software beyond the screen is so much more than just sensors and things like that. So what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, it's a great question. And IoT is a word I never use. Never, ever use. IoT, you know, normally stands for Internet of Things. But to me, that doesn't tell me anything. Internet of Things.
Yeah.
Even the first time I heard the word 15 years ago, I was like, what does that mean? So I think about software beyond the screen. And I use that expression because I'm an engineer. I'm computer science undergrad, been coding since I was a kid. I still code. And I love the beauty of software, especially in 2024. Software has these characteristics where it has settings, analytics, and updates. So this chair that I'm sitting on doesn't have any settings. I can't change the way it works. The company that made the chair doesn't know how the chair is being used.
Yeah.
And the company that made this chair can't update it, can't make it better. All of this is true for your iPad. All of this is true for your Apple Watch. All of this is true for your iPhone. That there's the creator of it has a stream of information as to how the product's being used and can continually make it better. That's a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's like everything in the real world physical is depreciating, is getting worse over time. Your Honda Civic gets worse every year, but a Tesla gets better every year, right? So for me, that's where this notion of software beyond the screen, software is agility, it's capital intensity, its ability to improve over time is beautiful, but it's been chained to a computer. And I literally mean, you know, chain, like you need to sit down, hit control, delete on a keyboard, use your mouse, click on login, and now you can use software. And we're seeing that change. This isn't a brand new trend. It's 5-10 years old, but you can get into your car and type in Google Maps. Your self-driving lane keeping assist features start to feel that way. Your Aura Ring starts to feel software-like. So to me, software beyond the screen is a huge idea that is going to have a many, many different incarnations, software beyond the screen. And now you know where this word ubiquity comes from, right? It's about software becoming ubiquitous in the real physical world. What that ends up meaning tactically, you know, I have 35 companies in the portfolio now, about half have a little bit of hardware. When software jumps off of a computer screen, it lands on something sometimes. And that could be, you know, a ring. I have a smart earbuds company. I have a cow collar company. So sometimes it lands on hardware. Sometimes it doesn't land on hardware. Instead, it's just software, but it's navigating, perceiving, understanding, actuating the real physical world. Mm-hmm. So half of my companies are a little bit of hardware, but all of them use a little bit of ML or AI, and it's all about this next phase. I'm giving you the nerd description.
Please.
If you wanted a business description, I would, which sounds a lot more boring to me, I would say there's a massive TAM expansion opportunity.
Yeah.
By bringing these technologies to offline industries.
Right. It's interesting because we see that so much. We call them legacy industries. You call them offline industries. Lior at Eclipse calls them hardline industries. We should all get together for drinks and pick one term that we can use because I feel like we're all talking about the same thing. But ultimately, you know, we've seen these industries have pushed back on digitization historically, and you know they're sort of coming online more now. Looking at the breadth of the things that you invest in, cow collars to satellites to energy systems. This question actually came for our mutual friend Rishi Taparia, who put us together. How do you get up to speed and get comfort with a market that you're investing in when you're so nerdy and early?
So we've talked about software beyond the screen as being a horizontal thesis in a way. You know, that's how I'm hearing your question. There are investors, many of our VC brethren focus on industrial, focus on ag tech, or in this SaaS space, focus on vertical SaaS. But it is a bit more where you can build some domain expertise in that industry. I would describe what I do as having domain expertise in the technologies employed, right? If you're doing something with the PCB circuit board, or you're doing something with LoRa connectivity, or you're doing something with the machine learning model, wherever you put that, whatever industry, I'm interested, right? I'll lean forward. And so the question remains, how do you intelligently take a technology into industry, decide if it's going to work or not? The first piece, the technology itself, you know, sometimes I call this deep tech, and investing at the bleeding edge, I do have an extended team of technical nerds, 50 people I've known for usually over 10 years or more, that help me to quickly vet these technologies and the technologists to make sure I'm not being fooled by snake oil. So someone could talk about the new version of OpenCV, and I want to make sure that I'm not going off the deep end, right? Getting fooled. Still doesn't address your actual, you know, question, which is when I made an investment in 2018, I co-led the seed round of Halter. This is a company that allows dairy farmers who make milk using cows, to generate more milk, sleep more, and that's sort of the short version of the ROI. Now, the way this occurs is through a smart cow collar, goes around the neck of a cow, and now you turn your cow into code. I'm giving you the nerd description. I mean that pretty literally. So if you're a coder, you know about objects like C++ and Java. You can send a command. It's called a method in programming speak, where you can trigger a command on the cow. You're not triggering biology in the cow. You're triggering the collar to do something with the cow. Mm-hmm. You can read information. You could say, where is my cow? How much have they eaten based on the tilt of their accelerometer? You can also write information to the cow. That is to say, actuate. You can tell the cow to move to this location. And that's accomplished through sound and vibration. So you have the ability to do this stuff. I get excited about the technology.
Yeah.
But then when I met that company in 2018, the question is, how do I ramp up on the dairy industry? How do I know?
So it's the sales cycle, right?
I'm right. All these quirks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to start, I would say that I'm looking for technologies that offer like a 10x improvement, which people say a lot, 10x. It's really, really big deal to do 10x better at something.
Yeah.
So it's not that you can do something twice as good. And then when I get into the industry details, it may erode the value proposition and that doesn't sell. But I think when you're 10x better at something, other vagaries of the industry, the sales cycle or regulate, other things can get in the way and you can still be 5x better, right? Like this is the value equation. So part of it is aiming high for the value proposition created. And then I think this is true for probably every single one of the 35 founders I've backed. They have this profile. Almost none of the founders I've backed are opportunistic entrepreneurs, meaning they were not smart people, looked at the trends and said, that's an industry I'm going to go after. The people that I back, amazing founders, work their tail off. They're technical, but they've been immersed in this industry for many years. So they lived and breathed it. They came into an annoying obstacle in that industry. And then because they knew the technology, so in the case of Halter, years prior when I was at Bessemer, we had co-led the Series B of Rocket Lab. They're now a public company, the only company besides SpaceX going to orbit regularly. The idea is someone at Rocket Lab, an engineer left and started Halter. So yep. Peter Beck is on my extended team, the CEO of Rocket Lab. He introduced me to Halter. And when I met the CEO, Craig, he talked about PCBs and LoRa and lithium ion batteries and about cows. And then he said, you know, I grew up working on a dairy farm for 20 years of my life. My family still has one. All my friends run dairy farms. And then I could go visit him and visit the farm and then talk to his friends. And then he could make some intros. I could go do some offsheet intros. But very quickly, I can size up the industry and the demand through a kind of humble entrepreneur who's deep in this sector. And that's been true for almost everybody, that depth. Now, tie it all together and it means that the industry signal should be strong and apparent so I don't have to be an expert. Right?
Yeah.
I'm not looking for a nuanced...
you're not going to find that in a Gardner report.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's more about like, if I had 5 words and I could present it to someone in the industry, they'd say, oh my God, we've been talking about that for a while. That's the high bar I'm looking for.
Yeah. One of the amazing things about Ubiquity is the one person, one theme, one stage ethos. Why do you feel like founders resonate with that? And then on the flip side, what have been some of the drawbacks or limitations that you found with that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I like that idea of trade-offs, right? That's clearly not the right way to do things. There's pros and cons with either method. You know, I came from a larger firm, Bessemer, where I was for 6 years. Multiple offices, multiple billions of dollars, multiple stages, multiple sectors. And Ubiquity is clearly a reaction to that, right? It's what if we went one stage, one focus, one office, one person, one theme? And I've loved it, absolutely loved it. And to your point, I think the founders I work with and the founders I meet love it as well. So I think first and foremost, there's this idea of the personal touch. Every pixel, every number, every communication, every first pitch meeting, I do myself.
Wow.
And I think that I, as a former founder, care a lot. I think, you know, I do about 1,000 pitches a year and in every one for 30 minutes and I invest in 5 companies. So rough numbers. In those 1,000 pitches, like 4 or 5 a day, I go through the same cycle. My wife doesn't believe this. Like I meet somebody, maybe sometimes it's sort of a silly pitch, but usually it's a pretty good pitch. I fall in love with the person. I fall in love with the idea. I get like revved up. Wow, this would be so cool. And then I have to flip on like, no, this won't work. This won't work. So it's this emotional roller coaster every single day.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've been doing this 13 years or something like that. So I'm used to it now, but I still like that I do fall in love and then I fall out of love all in 30 minutes and once in a while go deeper. And when I don't, you know, I try to be helpful genuinely as a personal touch. I sign everything with my own name in a sense. So I think that's a huge pro is the personal touch. My LPs, you know, I have 3 funds now, approaching $200 million under management. And I think my LPs also appreciate that there's a high level of accountability, high level of integrity, a high level of quality on everything mm-hmm. put out. And it's just one of these things when your neck is on the line, you know, you're going to, when there's no safety net, right? There's no one else to blame. You know, there's no one else to
push back to LPs and the solo GP thing. I mean, you know, I'm very fortunate that it's a partnership because yeah. that's the model that I always came up in, you know, back and forth in a, yeah. in a room, you kind of beat the idea up together. Whenever I've had to sit there and make a call myself, I definitely start, my hands start shaking, be like, I need somebody to bounce this off of. The LP conversation is always interesting because while solo GPs have become a little bit more in vogue, and I think the 2021 hype cycle was a part of that, you started a solo GP well before that.
Yeah.
What was the pushback that you got?
It's a good question. And we have to credit folks like Manu Kumar and others that were the Jeff Favier at Encore, prior SoftTech is what it was called.
Yes.
And Manu Kumar at K9, we had lunch yesterday. So okay. still consider him a mentor who paved the trail in 2009, 2010, you know, that phase. I started in 2017. It wasn't a well-paved trail in 2017. Nikhil at now Footwork, originally Shasta, yes. wrote that seminal blog post, Solo Capitalist, like coined the word. You put a word to something, it starts to make it look a little more legitimate. So, you know, LPs have had pushback, like you said, trade-offs. So there are trade-offs with getting input, decision-making, coverage, right? So I am worse at that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so the negatives are, I don't have 10 people, at Best Buy we were 50, meeting every company. I'm saying 10 because like a sector team.
Sure.
So I know that I'm not going to meet every company in a sector. By the way, I'm also not going to because of the stage. At Pre-Seed, people are quietly in their bedrooms. They're not at conferences. Yep. There's no articles about yep. them. But I know I'm not going to have coverage, and that's built into my underwriting, my pricing, my model. I know that I won't be able to have the same presence as larger firms. I know that I won't have the same intense adversarial thought dynamic that you're talking about,
yeah.
Where you have several people who are economically motivated to come to the best answer, right? Now, I'd say most firms have too many partners in the room, right? When you have 12, you get diffusion of responsibility. But if it's 2, I actually like that model personally. Mm-hmm. I could imagine doing that, like 2 people who are really fighting because I don't want to lose money, you don't want to lose money, you brought half the LPs, I brought half the LPs. My sister's in it, your sister's in it,
right.
And we both want to get rich, right? And we want to change the world. So there's an elegance, and so it's just a curve of like one person, too many people. I swung really far the other way. In terms of how LPs have reacted to this, I got some feedback. I think it's probably still true. Early in my pitching from another GP, they said, if an LP is not into single GP, they're not into a one decision-maker firm, don't try to convince them. You'll never succeed.
Yeah.
And I think to this day, I've never succeeded. You know, now I'm happy to say I have pension funds, university endowments, lots of institutional capital, but it's not because I could change their mind about single
yeah.
GP, right?
I think
it always starts with a kernel of interest, or they wanted to build a program, or they're interested in deep tech. And so it is a tricky dance. But the folks I have as LPs, lucky to have, are already bought into the trade-off that it's an interesting trade-off.
Yeah. One of the things that we keep trying to evolve as a firm. We are year 3 now. We started in 2021, closed in 2020, final closed in 22, and now are sitting here with about 18 investments under our belt, is always thinking about how we improve our decision-making. And I'm always reading, you know, about like what I'm nerdy about. I'm always nerdy about trying to understand better decision sciences, how people make decisions,
mm-hmm.
how they improve, how they, you know, iterate. There's some really great data came out of HBR, I think, in December, decision-making inside of venture funds. And what they found was the earlier the fund and the earlier the stage that you invest in, the best funds are asymmetric in decision-making in the sense of one person bangs the table
yeah.
and says, I have conviction in this team, this founder, this market, and everybody else says, you're crazy. And those deals end up doing really well. On the flip side, you get to that Series B where everybody's talking about, do we put a term sheet at 150 post or 170 post? And that's actually where consensus becomes the better driver of returns. So I'm just thinking about that from our perspective of how we make decisions.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like there are times where we both come into an idea loving it, and then one of us has to play the devil's advocate. On the flip side, there are some decisions where it's just like, go with me on this one. Like, I believe, and I'm here, and I'm going to help them. And, you know, the way I always say it is, you beat it up during the diligence process, but then when you invest, that's your baby.
Then you're
right
on board.
Now you're on board, yeah. And now my goal is to make sure every concern I had during diligence, I'm de-risking now as their investor. But that decision-making process is always so fun to me. What about your experience as a founder building and starting an early machine learning-enabled dating app informed the way you are now as an investor and a partner to these founders?
It's a very good question. So I moved out to Silicon Valley in 2009 and was a founder for 2 years. The first year, I had moved out right after business school. My co-founder quit on me like 2 days prior to that.
Wow.
So we had picked out an apartment, and then I didn't end up having a co-founder. So I know that emotional roller coaster, which repeated many, many times. I selected an apartment above a Subway and a Starbucks in Palo Alto. The Subway was going to be my cafeteria. Starbucks was going to be my boardroom. And I would go, it's almost sad to think in retrospect, probably 25 calendar days in a row and not leave like a 15-foot radius, right? Apartment, downstairs, up, work, crank. And so I think the point of that is there's an empathy, right? I still closely remember it. I still connect with my triangulate co-founders all the time. But that emotional journey, the day-to-day, the hour-by-hour, I think is one way that I connect with seed stage founders. And between the nerdy and the early, I have a deep feeling of what that feels like. Another piece of it is I like to think of Ubiquity as a bit of a training ground for more technical first-time founders. Most founders I back are first-time.
Yeah.
And so I can harken back to my own experience. How did I figure out what my first board meeting was? Tell you, for example, I signed a term sheet, raised on my seed round, and then I was racing to get an office just so I could have a room to host my first board meeting. I was kind of obsessed with the pomp and circumstance. Today we'd be like, what are you talking about? Just do it over Zoom. Just do it at the VC firm's office. Do it at a random like WeWork. But that nervousness, I remember at Triangulate, we had signed a term sheet for a three-person board. So myself, the Patricia at Nakasha Trinity Ventures, who's fantastic, and then we had an independent. And I remember I did not want to appoint that independent because, heaven forbid, the two of them gang up. Now, that's not Patricia's style, but it was in my head, you know, these concerns. So I can, to this day, I can kind of take off my VC hat and put on my entrepreneur hat and just see the world differently. I'm not an entrepreneur, right? Like, entrepreneur is much harder work.
Yeah.
But in the same way that I can take off my business hat and put on my technology hat. And I think that's really useful to look at any situation in both of those. So I think it helps my founders. It helps the connection. It helps the empathy. I don't walk into a room and sort of bang the table about millions of MRR. I'm more delicate about, you know, how are we going to do this? What are the implications? What are the emotions? Things like that.
Yeah. And as part of kind of your outreach to those technical founders, I saw some of the content you had put up on Ubiquity University.
Oh, great. Okay.
The board content, by the way, I thought was particularly compelling because there is so much information out there from YC, from, you know, name your next podcaster that's talking about the ethos of a founder, the you know, finding product market fit. And then it's like, okay, now I've raised money and I'm running this as a professional organization and I have people I'm accountable to. So I, you know, wanted to commend you on that. Maybe I'll ask it a different way. You know, one, what was the genesis of this? Was there a moment where you were like, I need to put this content out for more founders?
Yeah.
And maybe we'll come to a little bit more of which of these videos you think ought to be more popular, but isn't.
Sure. So, yes, there's definitely a moment where Ubiquity University sort of came into like, this is going to be something I spent some time on. In engineering, we have this idea of, these days we call it DRY, don't repeat yourself. When I was in high school in the 90s, and you wrote a function, I remember I wrote a Tetris game, so in C++. And if you wanted to center some text on the screen, you have a little bit of a function to sort of put the text in the right place.
Yep.
Later on, if you want to center text again, you don't write that again. You take that code, you put it into a function, and you call it, right? So it's called refactoring code. Now, do not repeat yourself. That notion of if you have to do something twice or more, put it somewhere as a resource and use that, right? So that was in the back of my mind as just an engineer. And what I found was as my portfolio grew, I shifted from being flattered when one of my entrepreneurs asked me for advice on a topic hey, Sunil, I want to hire a director of engineering. What's the right equity? Oh, okay. Let me tell you, you know, with my wisdom, let me share all my wisdom. And then 2 days later, another entrepreneur calls me in my portfolio. Hey, what's the right equity for a director of engineering? I'm like, shit, I should have just recorded myself. And that's what it is. That's what ubiquitous diversity is. Yeah. For those common things within my existing, and I think the critical piece is it's timely, right? It's 2024 centric. So as soon as I run into something two or three times, I record it, put it online, up-level the quality of it a little bit, of the advice. And that's where it started. It's also, I'd say that's probably half of the modules is common advice. Another half, you might even call them like me trying to eradicate some pet peeves, right?
Sure.
The board content, maybe the one you're talking about, it's called managing your mindset, nailing your mindset for your first board meeting. And I'll give you one example. There's probably five in there, but one, I remember this from Triangulate. So I graduated, I pitched terribly. So I pitched for like 9 months for my seed round. You never want to pitch for more than a few months, right?
Yeah.
As a technique. So from July until March, I was pitching for a 750K seed round. And you do something for 9 months, you get really good at the habit of doing it, right? You don't do donuts every morning. Every morning you don't want a donut. So pitching. And then I get the term sheet from Patricia Trinity, sign the term sheet. We have our first board meeting. And what do? Pitch. Oh, this is great. Oh, this is so cool. Here's a cool framework. And Patricia was kind about it. But now with my ubiquity companies, I'm less kind about it. I'm like, no, guys, turn off the selling. You know, sell customers, but don't sell me. I'm on your side.
Yeah.
You have my $2 million. I can't take it back. So that pet peeve, after a little bit, I was like, why don't I make a thoughtful, elegant video about this to convince founders it is a natural thing, but you have to forcefully flip the switch.
Yeah.
The minute the money arrives, no more games, no more packaging, no more storytelling.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we check in every quarter. Again, we don't lead, so I'm not maybe in sort of everybody's DMs the way maybe a lead investor is, but every quarter I have a check-in or a face-to-face with my founders, and it frustrates me to no end where I will have 2 to 3 quarters of everything is great and up and to the right, and then the fourth quarter is nothing is working and we need more money. Mm-hmm. And you're like, there's no way that happened in the last 3 months. So clearly, there were aspects of this stuff that were happening that you weren't sharing with your investors. And the worst is when the lead is also caught off guard, because then it just comes back to, okay, fundamentally, you're not operating with the transparency that this partnership demands.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's just expectation setting that we need to do as investors early on, or it's bad coaching that founders are getting elsewhere. Like, I don't know why it's happening.
There's a lot of bad advice out there. That's another reason for Ubiquity University. There's just so much, unfortunate advice. But in this case, I understand, you know, why it happened.
Mm.
As a founder, as a VC, your fundamental, this is a sad part of the difference between VC and entrepreneurship. VCs, our nature is to say no. As entrepreneurs, your nature is to say yes, right? How do I find this person? How do I surmount this challenge? How do I do that? So it's easy to let that spin into always being positive, right? Every CEO is always killing it, right? Like, so between that and you've been pitching for a long time, so you have to kind of turn that off. And with a very close circle of trusted folks, you have no guys, you have no facade. You're just like, hey, it's really crappy today. I don't know, you know? And that does require some trust from investors. Like I tell some of my founders, you know, actually the day after I wire, so generally speaking, you sign a term, you do some diligence, sign a term sheet, about 30 days later, you wire and you close. The next morning, I always have this, all 35 companies, I have a kickoff call. And we talk about three things. We talk about sort of the targets for this round for 5 minutes, just a quick check-in. We talk about working style and ground rules. And that's a really important one. And I tell folks, listen, you know, this is a way to reach me. This is not the way, you know. And one of them is, I promise I'm a big boy. I've been doing this a while. You can tell me anything and I promise not to freak out.
Yeah.
I've unfortunately been part of companies where there was stealing of company funds. With sexual harassment, and that I'm not proud of that, but I can just tell you, it's not going to faze me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I hope that convinces them to just tell me everything right off the bat, you know. Actually, to tell them, there's only one way to piss me off, which is not telling me something. If I find out about something later, it's the string that you can't unravel anymore, and you can't re-ravel, you know, re-tie back up again. So,
my favorite quote is, "Organizations move at the speed of trust."
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have that, if you don't have that, then fundamentally you are operating with one arm behind your back.
Yeah.
And so the more that, you know, look, part of the reason we do what we do on the PR side is successful PR shortcuts to trust.
Mm-hmm.
If you are sharing about your company in a way that resonates with your customer, then that first pitch meeting doesn't have to be you selling them 100%. They're already 20, 25% of the way there, right?
Yeah.
And that to me is, I think, where trust becomes really valuable. that same way it works inside of an organization. Whether it's, you know, again, back to the PR example, but if you're using it for hiring and they know what a great culture you have and they know why people love working and believe in your mission and, you know, think you're the founder that is really going to make a dent in this industry, that trust is already there when you come in for that, you know, your first day or your first meeting or your first one-on-one. And the inverse is also true. And I think that's where it becomes really challenging because you have so many things stacked up against you as a founder. If you are then making your job harder by not bringing people who want to help you into that circle of trust, it's like, yeah, you're not operating at the speed of trust.
Well, I like what you said about marketing, kind of lubricating many areas of the business. I think some first-time founders, myself included, looked at it as like, well, I need to pay a monthly retainer and I'll get two articles, right? And if I get these two articles, I'll be able to send my mom something so she knows that I'm not screwing around.
Yeah,
that I'm actually successful. And I think marketing and PR firms don't like that either because no. They're like, you know, it doesn't work that way. It takes a few months, but it's a mismatch, right? Because technical founders have like metrics and code and runtime and CAC and LTV and conversion events and it's boom, boom, boom. And some of this stuff is a little less immediate, not tight closed feedback loop, and impacts so many things, right? And makes people proud to work there. It reduces the option grants you have to give because people are more excited.
Yeah.
Conflict. It makes people work harder, you know, on top of feeling good that you're in TechCrunch or that you have this great valuation you've
been size. Our listeners have heard me say this, but maybe this is new for you. I say there's only one of three reasons that you want to do PR. It's to reach new customers, to reach prospective employees, to reach potential investors. If you're doing it for not one of those three reasons, you're doing it for ego, and that's a waste of your money and time, right? And so I think you said it much more eloquently, but I think that's certainly a lesson whenever I'm meeting a founder that says, hey, we'd love to have you on our cap table. We know you guys do a lot of, you know, PR and marketing work, and it's like, you're not at a stage where that's going to be valuable for you. You know, why do you really need PR and marketing? Bringing it back to, you know, one of the most, I think, compelling things to me and why I was so excited to sit down with you, Ubiquity has one of the highest graduation rates to Series A that, I mean, you've shared and from every one of our peers that I've heard, you know, is true. What is it about your process that resonates with those downstream investors? You know, why is it that you're able to have one of those highest graduation rates to Series A?
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. It is, so let's contextualize a little bit. The startups that we back are generally not going concerns on their own, right? They're raising money and they're choosing to be unprofitable to get to a larger prize, right? They're spending quicker than is sustainable. It's not like a bakery. It's a company that raises $1 million and in 12 months will be out of cash. So they're constantly going downhill and need more oxygen. And so this idea of access to capital is a critical component of this whole game. When you or I lead a pre-seed or a seed round, there's a notion of raising the next round, the Series A, and how to access that capital. In the industry, different metrics, YC will, on their webpage, will say that when one of their companies raises a seed after the incubator, about 30% of the time they raise a Series A. And I think triangulate my startup, I raised a seed, I didn't raise a Series A. Mm-hmm. So I was in that 70%, just to be clear. Now, Ubiquity above a 90% seed to Series A graduation rate.
Wow.
I'd say that there's a few reasons for that. Number one, by far, is tons of hard work by these entrepreneurs, right? Building out the team, building out the product, finding customers, working their tail off day and night. With that foundation, I can do a lot with that. Some of the things that I do, I think it comes down to picking, and I don't just mean picking great companies, whatever that means. I mean following where the puck is going on three dimensions. I even have a slide that I present to my LPs every LP meeting about this. The Wayne Gretzky skate to where the puck is going. Number one is what just became technically possible recently. And LLMs would be an example now.
Yeah.
But following that trend and doing that not by reading Gartner reports, but like hanging out every month or so, I have different PhDs or engineers over to my house for like wine and cheese or beer and pizza. So following it from like first principles, new technologies and where they're going. Number two, following what customers want. And this would be like thinking about these larger corporations, what's on their mind that month. It changes month to month, just like, you know, a lot of other things. So it's not that this is the annual priority. And then the last one, which I used to think it was just those two things, the intersection of what's technically possible recently and what do customers want. If you get that right, It's not easy to get that right, by the way, because sometimes customers don't know what they want. There's that famous Steve Jobs quote. But the last part of the puck, the Venn diagram, is following what Series A, B, Cs will fund. And it took a while to appreciate this. At first, it was like, if I'm right about the technology and the customers, I deserve to win, or I deserve for that company. That's it. That should be the sufficient. It's not me winning, it's Entrepreneur winning, but like the whole package should work. And it turns out, you know, if the capital is not there because of this model of oxygen, you need oxygen no matter what, I can be totally right, the founder can be totally right, and they'll still die, right? So I do spend quite a bit of time following how VCs, later stage, Series A, B, VCs are thinking about, how they're talking about. I'll give you an example. When I was a Bessemer in 2011, 2017, in 2012, 2013, we used to talk about net negative churns.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we talk about net dollar retention.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, but they're just different words. And so following how the words are shifting, we used to say green tech, I mean, clean tech, now we say climate, right?
Like, yeah.
I'm giving you somewhat trivial examples, but imagine that times 100, just knowing the zeitgeist, knowing the trends, following that is a critical piece of puzzle. So armed with that, I have a fantastic founder, exciting business, and then following the zeitgeist of these trends and these things, you put them together, and that leads to a lot of stuff I do around helping to manage the process, the timing, the techniques, the words, the slides, the intros, all of that. Once you have the base, doing that stuff really well can double the graduation.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not fooling anyone. I'm trying to get these amazing technologies that are important to customers funded, but it's not always so obvious to make that happen, especially in tech.
You want to remove the whether it's, you know, the verbiage hurdles or the preparedness hurdles.
Yep.
More of those hurdles that you can remove that just allows the founder who is nerdy and early to share their vision with an investor who is generally, you know, wants to invest in it, and then all this other crap gets in the way. The more that you can eliminate that, I mean, that's your role as a board partner. I love this idea of not only having, you know, a prepared mind as an investor, but a prepared mind as a board partner. Somewhat contrarian, given that you've said yourself, a lot of your peers think being a board partner at seed stage is a waste of time.
Yeah.
So why is that so important to you, and why is it such a contrarian idea today?
It's a great question. So we could zoom out and I'll tell you at Bessemer, two of the most successful famous investors at Bessemer, both mentors of mine. I'm not going to say who, but they're two of the most successful folks there. One would say you should back great founders and get the hell out of their way.
Yeah.
The other would say you need to back folks and help them like crazy. Now, both of those sentences sound great. They're complete opposites, just to be crystal clear. You couldn't say two things further from the truth. This gets back to trade-offs, right? I mean, who knows which one's better? At the pre-seed and seed stage, I believe what ends up happening is that there's this, I'm going to call it a downward spiral, but it's probably not a downward spiral. It's just a sort of internally consistent set of beliefs. You invest in a few different areas because you don't know what's going to happen in those areas. Because you're following a lot of areas, you see how it's already getting circular? Because you're following a lot of areas and you invest in a lot of companies, you can't help them that much because you got to have a lot of companies. So now you need to make smaller bets. And you end up with this larger portfolio of disparate bets where you're interrupt-driven. Interrupt-driven means when the founder asks you for something, you answer, but otherwise you sort of leave them alone or you don't have time for them. So this would be a 40, 50 company portfolio with lots of bets, and it's one model. But the center of that theme is you don't know what's going to happen.
Right? And your win condition, by the way, also changes. I think of it like, you know, games. The win condition here is because you own so little of it, each one has to necessarily be $2 to $5 billion outcome
I completely agree,
by the time it exits, right?
Yep.
Because it's so disparate.
Yeah, let's say you own 2% in this model. In my model, I aim to own 10 to 20%.
Yeah.
I aim to have a board seat with monthly board meetings. I have a concentrated portfolio of about 20 companies, 18 to 20 companies. You could call this a Series A model, by the way. This looks like a Series A firm. I think most importantly or controversially, I do know what's going to happen, right? So here, a lot of areas, a lot of companies, small ownership, you don't know what's going to happen. I don't really know what's going to happen, but I keep a tight focus, a tight watch, a tight involvement so that the smaller number of bets, but when they work, like you're saying, 10, 20% with some dilution, maybe it's 10 or 5% at exit, $1 billion exit could return the fund, right? Versus multi-billion dollars or $100 billion, which don't come that often. Because I'm backing first-time technical founders, I can get more attractive entry prices, but then I can coach them through Ubiquity University and a bunch of other stuff and fundraising, make them stronger. So it's a win-win and they come out. I'd say it's net better. Like it'll have a higher Series A valuation. So the valuation trade-off would be a wash. And so all of this comes together to make it more like a, I say this sometimes, you know, I have a 7-year-old daughter, right? And I treat her like an adult.
Yep.
And I have since she was like 2 years old.
Okay.
I think that'll make her a better adult, right? And that's controversial, by the way, right? Like she's never thought Santa is real, for example. Very controversial among her parents. I explain everything to her. She asks questions about everything. So I don't think entrepreneurs are children. It's just the idea that if you treat a child like an adult, they grow up into better adults. If you treat a pre-seed 2-person team as if it's a real Series A company with 20 people and millions of ARR from day zero, I believe they grow up into better Series A companies. If they prepare board materials for 20 minutes, not for a 20-minute board meeting, but have that every month to mark the passage of time, to check in on milestones, most seed companies don't do that. And so then they start to operate in a certain cadence, develop good strategies, to sit up straight, like all that stuff. It creates a stronger company.
The irony of that, by the way, is that putting together a deck for a 3-hour meeting every 3 months feels so much more onerous than putting together a couple of slides for a 20-minute check.
Exactly.
This
is the bad advice we were alluding to earlier.
Yeah.
I might even have a Ubiquity session, otherwise I'm going to make one about this. It is deceptive. Some of the entrepreneur advice. One will be like, founders will say, I raise money and I don't even have to have a board. I mean, why don't you have a board of people you like that want to help you, right? Or a version more relevant to what you're saying is, we only have board meetings once a quarter. It's great. First, it's more work. There's a higher bar for expectation of quality and thoroughness. And then the thing that I think is fatal to entrepreneurs and they don't realize it is surprises. 3 months, 90 days is a long time for surprises. Never mind that a VC meets about 200 companies in between pitches. We've forgotten everything from the last board meeting.
Yeah.
When you do them 90 days apart.
Yeah.
When you do them 30 days, I kind of remember most of this. There's fewer surprises. It'll be smoother. You can use the acronym and I won't get lost. You know, like, so to your point, I think the net benefit is actually less work by far to do. I mean, let alone you're getting more help, you're getting more involvement, you're sort of building the right cadence to your company. So I like that a lot, these monthly things. But you know, even to this day, some VCs flip out when I tell them that we do monthly board meetings. They're like, why are you forcing me to do this? Because they're thinking of it as a 3-hour intense formal board meeting where you do the pre-meeting, the post-meeting, this and that. But are just really checking in to make sure we're building quickly.
Yeah. So Ubiquity is not a climate fund per se. You know, I feel like there's a lot of climate tech VCs today and some of them are generalists and some of them have actually been building in this since climate 1.0. As you look at the archetype of the founders that are nerdy and early and building in climate, is there something specific that you need to see that makes you go, this person is going to you know make an impact here? And on the flip side, we come back to this idea of trade-offs. Are there certain behaviors or things that you have to watch out for to help them avoid kind of pitfalls as a first-time founder?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know that it's a climate-specific answer. I think for any deep tech stuff, there's this spectrum I think about a lot. And I would refer to it as like the way an entrepreneur talks in my first pitch meeting. They could say, look what I could do. Now, hey, I'm at Google, but if I left, I could make a new model. You know, that's okay.
Mm.
They could say, look what I did, which is, nights and weekends. So that's work ethic, hunger, excitement, nerdiness. Nights and weekends, I've got this new computer vision model that can recognize trees in a forest by species, I think. That's pretty good. Even better is, look what it accomplishes, right? And so, I built this thing, sure, but now I'll be able to tell farmers which trees to cut down first. And then the last stop, the most exciting stop is look who cares, right? So this spectrum is really about tech innovation to customer impact. And for everything in deep tech, it's just grand irony, like to have the confidence to jump into deep tech, usually you have to be super technical. If you're super technical, then you're into the technology, right? Back to the nerdiest, you want to live here. But I need to find folks who can do this, but then are still thinking deeply about
spending
customer
time
impact.
With customers.
So for climate, that's definitely the case, right? Somebody could know everything about like an 18% efficacy photovoltaic cell and all the PN junction, all that stuff inside, but they have to really quickly be able to turn that off and turn on the customer impact, the empathy, the customer development, Steve Blank, all that stuff. So that's true for kind of any company in deep tech is this customer obsession with a fluency in the technology, but not an obsession.
Yeah, so our mutual friend, Nate Williams, wanted to make sure I asked this because, you know, as we're talking about shared love of deep tech, you wrote a blog post that I think struck a nerve with a lot of people called Moonshot Culture is Killing Deep Tech. Give us the highlights. We're going to make sure we link it in the show notes, but give us the highlights and why do you think it's such a such something that the industry needs to hear as they're thinking about tech?
I'm smiling because you're a marketer as well. Like, I changed the title to Strangling Deep Tech. I wanted to really,
really that evocative.
I mean, it's this like beautiful thing that's coming, and sort of this charlatan is coming, strangling this idea. So let's define that for a second. So many people, even as recently as last week, were like, "Still, why do you hate moonshots?" I don't hate moonshots. I don't hate ambitious projects. There is this culture around building a normal startup. When you build a normal startup, you follow the rules, you raise a little bit of capital, you make some progress, you raise more capital, you think about CAC. There's a whole playbook around building a normal startup. And the issue is when you break out of that norm, the mainstream startup world, you can quickly go off the deep end. And you can say, you know what, I'm not doing a SaaS startup. I don't have to follow that rule or that rule. I can break all the rules, right? And now you're off doing truly crazy stuff with a crazy amount of capital. And in particular, you could name, you know, a host of these companies that blow up after raising $1 billion. I think that's dangerous for the sector. I think it can create a nuclear winter for a whole sector where too much capital goes in. It was risky capital, but then when it fails, everyone says, see, I told you so. I knew that was a bad idea. That wasn't actually what it was. So I would say the essence of moonshot culture has to do with abandoning rules and raising large amounts of capital out of phase with the typical sequencing of when to raise at the right time and increased amounts as you de-risk the project. There are many in the last few months that just sort of come out of stealth and raise a bunch of money. And I don't love that because it can create bad habits. And the opposite of that is nurturing a technology, refining it, raising some more capital, finding customers, raising some more capital, scaling. And that discipline, both in the playbook and the financing, what that results is in a healthier, more likely to succeed process, more replicable process. And that, I think, is great. It's just, it's too tempting to say, I'm doing deep tech. I don't have to follow the rules.
Is that a function of the size of your fund, though? Because when I look at, you know, I'll give you an example because they're in the news this week. Founders Fund backed Varda, and they're doing pharmaceuticals in space, and it's a big satellite company. And if you're sending satellites up today, it's cheaper today than it ever was before. They still got to raise $100 million to really build a scalable business here. Well, that's a multi-billion-dollar fund, and they can keep writing check after check. Whereas, you know, I would say funds of our size, our fund is smaller than yours, but, you know, let's say a $75 million fund isn't necessarily in a position to keep kind of re-upping with bigger and bigger checks without the customer traction.
Good question. And I can see why someone might think that, you know, self-serving, you know, raise small amounts because I have a small fund. I think why I'm saying this. What I'm hoping for is to avoid massive blow-ups. So I don't want to avoid massive ideas, but I think it's literally this where I'm coming back to sequencing. So if you have this idea, Varda, microgravity production of different assets, including pharmaceuticals, I think they landed something yesterday or today. I think there's a staging and a sequencing. I think of all startups as a hypothesis tree. And you might think of a startup as only 10 questions. Can we get something to orbit? Can we bring something down from orbit? Can we get a motor working in microgravity? Or maybe it's, do customers want to pay $1,000 per grant? You know, like there's a set of questions. And I think supposed to, and I think you should, sort those questions, get the highest risk, lowest cost items out of the way first. And this is the issue with moonshot culture is, screw it. We have so much money. This is such a big idea. I'm charismatic. I can raise a bunch of money. I don't need the hypothesis tree. I'm just going to go for it. Right? No, you don't understand. I don't need to do that stuff. Right? That's the part I hate. So even if you're doing, and I have two satellite companies in my portfolio now.
Yeah.
I've done many space companies in the past, Rocket Lab, Spire, a few others. Today, Muon Space and Loft Orbital. And I think there is the notion of like sequencing it so that you can raise a small amount of capital and prove certain things before you raise more capital and prove certain things. So it's not self-serving with Ubiquity's fund size. It is self-serving with Triangulate, my old startup. I'm happy to, you know, it sucked. Experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. Triangulate failed. But I'm happy that I came to that conclusion having only spent about $600,000 of the $750K. What that means is all of the folks, basically everyone who invests in Triangulate is now an LP in Ubiquity. Right? Mm-hmm. We're still close friends with everybody. And that is, I think it would be different if we had raised $50 million for Triangulate, you know, sort of digging a bigger hole. So I'm a fan of lightweight experimentation. I love this idea of Steve Blank's definition of a startup, a temporary organization built to search for a repeatable business model. And the critical word there is temporary, which means if I back you, doesn't work, that's fine. It was temporary, right? Like if you find something, great, you know, but there's no hard feelings. And I think that works with $1 million. It does. I think there are hard feelings when you waste 10, when you lose 10 million. So,
oh yeah, no,
let alone 100 or a billion, like some of these moonshot ideas.
As we wrap, I always love to ask, what is a piece of advice you find yourself giving very often that doesn't get taken often enough?
Yeah, I think a piece of advice that is easy to ignore or rationalize away is to pick one thing and focus. Right? Mm. It's so true in startups that there's a Pareto where all the tasks you have and all the balls you have to juggle all seem important. They all seem like things will happen if they don't get done. But there's really like one or two things that really matter. And there's one or two customers that really matter at this earliest stage. And there's one or two employees that really matter. So it's hard. And generally, I get ignored when I offer this advice. You know, what is the thing that we should talk about today? What is the one thing? Well, I have all these things, you know, or what is the one thing that I could do for you today? But I think, you know, we talk about highest order bit and specifically in a binary number, the first highest order bit is 50% of the value of the binary number just by virtue of base two stuff. So that's a perfect analogy, right? There's one thing that matters at least as much as everything else. If you can find that and pause from all the juggling of the balls, pick the one thing, find it, takes a minute to find it and nail that, a lot of the other stuff sort of fades away.
Yeah, just to riff on that for a second, is that something that the founder inherently or the CEO inherently needs to be the driver of that focus? Or can you as an investor help herd some of those idea cows and bring
it's a great question. This is a good reason to have a board member even at the seed stage. I'm not building the company, but I know the person intimately, deeply involved, but I'm outside the company. So I can offer that, look around a corner they can't see around, look at 10 other of my companies and see what's similar. You know, so that perspective, that context, the pointing out the more important thing from an outside perspective, I think is really helpful for entrepreneurs. So they should be thinking about this, but I can often guide them in that just because I'm out of the day-to-day.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Yeah. I'll close with you where I love to close with all of my guests. You know, you're a dad. My son's about to be 1 year old on Monday.
Okay.
Gotcha. And I think about this quite often because I read more news than I probably should. And it's easy to get sucked into the doom and gloom of how much work we need to be doing in the climate transition, how slowly it's happening, how little the leaders around us are maybe taking it seriously. But then we do the work that we do every day and get to meet the founders that are building these companies. So what is it about the technologies or the companies or the founders that you meet that keeps, you know, you hopeful and gives you optimism about this fight against climate change?
It's a great question. There are so many people working on different aspects of climate. It covers so many different areas. In my own portfolio, I have something that improves trucking fuel efficiency and carbon emission, something that improves forestry, something that improves satellite-based climate monitoring, something that improves electric vehicle charging. So many different technologies. And we've, through the power of IRA, the Recovery Act, and then a few other things, and capitalism, we've pulled in so many bright minds. Instead of working on ad optimization technology, right? That's an easy thing to knock on. They're now working on fixing these critical issues and driving a huge profit along the way, which is an important part of the puzzle. Profit for the business, profit for investors. I think the stage is set for a lot of big movement. And just being at this pre-seed, seed stage, I see so much activity. And this phase is a lot more approachable than the clean tech phase 10 years ago. That was you had to put on a bunny suit, the clean suit, and touch the electronics.
Yep.
This time you're writing code. And just like we've done for Angry Birds 10 years ago, you're not writing code that's going to help to fix problems. So I'm not sure. I can't say it's going to work, but I can tell you tons and tons of smart people and capital and resources are deployed towards it.
That's a wonderful place to leave it, Sunil. Thank you so much for this really engaging conversation. And I know we took it in a couple of different directions, but hopefully I think our listeners are going to be better for it. So I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of Climb and hope we'll get to do it again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Jay.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's episode of Climb by VSC. Thank you so much for watching and listening. My thanks to my guest, Sunil Nagaraj from Ubiquity Ventures, for joining us and sharing his journey and experience with us today. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to every episode of Climb? In addition to Apple and Spotify, we are on YouTube. We drop full episodes every Wednesday, and we drop clips every single day. So there's a lot of content. Keep scrolling. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to leave us 5-star reviews. And if you really loved this episode, I would love for you to recommend a guest to us. We'd love to have them on the show. Well, that's it for now. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Climb by VSC. We'll see you all next week.